It's Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. One Kennedy, picked as his running mate, Lyndon Baines Johnson, then master of the Senate, would go on to be the prime mover of the most important civil rights legislation since Lincoln. Another, shot down before we could really tell, might have picked as his running mate John Connally, or maybe Stuart Symington of Missouri, who also bestrode government institutions. They represented the conservative wing of their party. This Kennedy, RFK Jr., picked Nicole Shanahan, who is described in headlines as RFK Jr. named Silicon Valley attorney Nicole Shanahan as running mate. That from CNN. Okay, she's an attorney. Here's another CNN article. Who is Nicole Shanahan? Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s vice presidential pick, it goes on to say, independent presidential candidate, RFK, named Silicon Valley attorney and entrepreneur Nicole Shanahan as his vice presidential pick at a campaign rally Tuesday in her hometown of Oakland. The 36-year-old first-time candidate enters the race largely unknown to the public outside of tech circles, but was an early supporter of Kennedy. And then it goes on to quote her, and then it goes on to quote her some more. And then it offers some analysis. Kennedy's campaign is hoping Shanahan's youth and fluency in the tech world's anti-establishment rhetoric will help him expand and excite his base of support. Talks a little bit about some vaccine skepticism that she's engaged in. And then it does allow the deep-pocketed investor could also provide a financial boost to backstop Kennedy's expensive campaign. Huh, she could. The investor could. Here's how RFK himself described his new running mate.
Her very, very American journey took her to a career as a patent attorney and as a Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur and as a Stanford University fellow.
Okay, I mean, from what I understand, from what I'm reading, she's brilliant. She's a big deal. She's a heavy hitter. I mean, she's an investor. She apparently made a lot of money. I mean, perhaps behind a great fortune, there lies a great crime. But I don't think she did it with a SPAC trading at $2,000 times revenue. Let's find out more. Here's the Washington Post asking the question I want answered. Who is Nicole Shanahan, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s pick for running mate? In making the announcement, Kennedy said he was looking for someone who shared his passion for wholesome, healthy foods, chemical-free, regenerative agriculture for good soils. Yes, it's a soil-based candidacy. Kennedy, it goes on. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it goes on for 500 words before it gets to a heading that says she was married to Sergey Brin. Now, you probably knew that Nicole Shanahan is the ex-wife of Google founder and 100 billionaire Sergey Brin, but my gosh, did the media seem loath to put that information up top. The inverted pyramid went splat when it comes to the important things to know about Nicole Shanahan. Politico listed 55 things to know about Nicole Shanahan. She is Sergey Brin's ex-wife, number 17. They did mention it in the text early on, but come on. If you asked me, hey, who'd RFK pick as his running mate? And I'd have answered, oh, you know, he picked a lawyer, an entrepreneur, and a former patent attorney who likes soil. I would say you should stop being my friend at that point, because I have misled you. What I need to say, what any decent person would say if they actually want to tell you who he picked, is he picked Sergey Brin's ex-wife. They're divorced, but she's a billionaire, reports would have it. There was some prenup issues. I will allow her her private life. I will allow her and not even get into rumors. Any rumors, rumors that she wrote about in People magazine while being pictured in free-flowing, breathable fabrics. That's fine. The important thing to know politically is that she's got a lot of money. And why does she got a lot of money? She was married to Sergey Brin for a few years, 4 years, I believe. Let us not deny the woman her agency. She made a speech. Why was she running? She laid out some concerns that I think a lot of Americans could identify with, though maybe in her case, she identifies with these concerns to a fairly extreme degree.
It makes me angry to say it because we shouldn't be here right now. Second, is electromagnetic pollution. You don't hear politicians talking much about that either, but it is something we need to look at. As Bobby says, we need to investigate every possible cause of chronic disease epidemic that is devouring our nation from the inside.
She was, by the way, speaking into a microphone as she said that, and this was her proposed solution.
I am going to assemble the best technologists and scientists in the world, and we will use the latest in AI and computation to examine the health records databases of our nation and those other nations who are also on a quest to solve chronic disease.
The platform for AI solving electromagneticism. It might seem a bit contradictory, but what do I know, right? I just know that she has $1 billion after being married to the head of Google, the co-founder of Google for 4 years, and you really need to know that too. And you know what? Look at all she's accomplished. She seems very smart. She really was an attorney who was apparently a somewhat of a big deal in the tech world when she met Sergey Brin, who is the co-founder of Google and worth over $100 billion. So I say more power to her. But the vice presidency? No, not that much power. On the show today, some thoughts on the near famine conditions we're hearing about in Gaza, which brings me to my guest. David Simon is an assistant dean for graduate education and senior lecturer in global affairs and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He joins to discuss the genocide accusations against Israel, which before the International Court of Justice, the ICJ. We also talk about that court and their power, or what power they might have and might not have. It's an interesting conversation. David Simon is up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The International Court of Justice has ruled that it is plausible that Israel has committed genocide in Gaza. But what does that mean? What are the implications? What comes next? These are obvious questions, but I have a great guest to talk about this and other aspects of the designation of genocide. He is David Simon. not the guy from The Wire, much better. The assistant dean for graduate education at Yale, a senior lecturer in global affairs, and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. David, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we could start with any of the terms, but let's start with plausible. What's the legal distinction in judging that it is plausible that Israel committed genocide?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's a really good question, because I don't know that there is a precedent that really defines a standard of plausibility, particularly with respect to genocide. There's just not that much jurisprudence out there in international courts. So plausible is kind of in the eye of the beholder, the eye of the 15 judges or 14 of them, because the Ugandan judge, notoriously now, found that there was no plausible case whatsoever. And, it, you know, essentially,
I would say 14 and two thirds of them, right?
Right, exactly.
Because the Israeli judge agreed with two of the six charges.
That's right. Although he didn't necessarily dispute the plausible side quite as much. I mean, it really was on that issue of the plausibility of finding intent where the Ugandan representative fell off from the rest.
Right. Practically, though, the actual adjudication, if it comes, will take a long, long time, judging from the other cases and allegations of genocide that have come before this tribunal. Can you quicker than the court itself would, go through some of those?
Sure. There's a case raised. One of the first ones was just a couple of years ago by the Gambia, raising a case accusing Myanmar of genocide. Genocide against the Rohingya. And this was kind of a groundbreaking case because the Gambia is in West Africa, Myanmar is in Southeast Asia. What standing does the Gambia have in that case? The ICJ recognized the Gambia's standing, basically saying, hey, you're a country within the world, a signatory of the Genocide Convention, and we all have all countries have signed have some standing to invoke the measures that bring the court's judgment in. What's more, the Gambia is a predominantly Muslim nation, member of the Union of Islamic States, and you may have had some additional standing there. But the important part is what the ICJ, once it recognized standing, it issued some provisional measures, which are actually fairly similar to the provisional measures that the ICJ issued in the South Africa's petition. And now it's here, that was, I believe, 2021 that the case came out, that the provisional measures initial ruling came out. It's been sort of slow going ever since, compiling evidence back and forth on, occasional hearings. One of the provisional measures was that the government of Myanmar should report to the ICJ, much as the ICJ requested the government of Israel to issue reports on its whether or not it's following up on all the other provisional measures. And even though the government in Myanmar is a completely unaccountable military junta that is one of the bad actors in this world, they are dutifully filing their reports with the ICJ, which is sort of an encouraging sign, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's easy to file the paperwork, easier than to stop the persecution, if not the genocide, of the Rohingya. But a couple questions from this. So that's a 2021 case, but there are cases with the Balkan states that took much longer than that, right?
Right. Bosnia, after the Dayton Accords had ended the war there, essentially between Bosnia and Serbia, Bosnia sued Serbia in the International Court of Justice, saying, "Hey, you were party to or complicit in the genocide at Srebrenica." They were. I believe when they filed the suit, the ICTY, the temporary court that had criminal jurisdiction over potential crimes in the former Yugoslavia, they had ruled that the events in Srebrenica in 1995 amounted to a genocide. So Bosnia says, hey, we know that Serbia was effectively arming the militias that were responsible for the genocide, They were Bosnian Serb militias. They weren't, it was not the Serbian army. The so they sued Serbia, saying, and it basically they weren't looking at that point to stop anything. The combat was over. The war was over. The genocide was over at that point. But they were looking for global recognition that Serbia was somehow responsible for the genocide. What the court ruled after, you know, it was so many years that when it came out, people sort of scratched their heads and said, oh, that,
right.
We're still adjudicating that.
Right, most of the people who escaped the genocide had already died of natural causes.
Well, I don't know if it was quite that long, but it was 8 to 10 years afterwards.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, since many of those who survived were the elderly, that's actually entirely plausible. But the court did rule that Serbia had, because Serbia had some influence over the Bosnian Serb militias, they were responsible for not doing everything in their power to stop those militias from committing genocide. They stopped sort of short of saying this is complicity,
yeah.
But they did say you, Serbia, had a responsibility under the Genocide Convention that you failed.
This is a correction I've been meaning to make on my show. I have said that the ICJ has only ever found one entity guilty of genocide. They actually have never found an entity flat out guilty of genocide. But as you say, they pointed the finger and said, you didn't stop genocide.
That's correct. And, you know, in some sense, the ICJ, it's not even really in a position to literally find anyone guilty. It can declare that a genocide has happened. It can declare that a country has failed in its responsibilities. But, you know, finding someone guilty, usually that's an individual, and that becomes the jurisdiction of the criminal courts, the ICC or an ad hoc court.
Right. And if you're looking for justice there, let's keep in mind that Milosevic was arrested in 2001 and died in 2006, but he was still on trial.
He was still on trial. Yeah. And, you know, these are for crimes ostensibly committed in the early 90s,
right.
Although they added Kosovo in at the end as well.
So the finding of plausibility, there were, and I read much of, I'm not going to say I read all the ruling, but I read much of the rulings. And Israel's answer to this, apart from objecting, you know, different actors within Israel said different things, a general objection to even the implication that there was a genocide, but then you have the ad hoc judge, each country accused of the crime and who brings the case gets to put one of their justices on the court temporarily. And the Israeli justice was Aaron Barak, who is a former Israel Supreme Court chief justice. Is that right?
That's right.
So he did agree with a couple of the findings or signed on to them. But my question is, mostly what Israel was officially saying was, this doesn't change our behavior, not because we're being recalcitrant, but we were essentially never guilty of this behavior. And the rulings from the court says you have to now follow international law, and they have always maintained their following international law. So even if the junta in Myanmar might be changing its actions, and I don't know, you tell me if they are, or just filing paperwork, it doesn't seem that Israel is changing its actions or even reads the ruling and says there's anything here compelling us to do anything differently than we say and maybe even we earnestly believe we've already been doing.
Yeah, I think there might be a little bit more nuance to the Israeli response than...
There always is with Israel.
Yeah, than pure cynicism. I think that, you know, you can start with noting the two... the two measures that Barak agreed with and signed off on, recognizing that Barak is an ad hoc judge, he was not a representative of the government. He was a representative of the country. So he's not articulating government policy in his votes on that panel. But one was the commitment to prevent and punish incitement. And even before, sort of in January, maybe even as early as December, the government of Israel started to be aware of the sort of liability that came when members of the IDF, members of the government, members of the governmental authority on the occupied territories if they said things that sounded like genocidal intent, that raised, first of all, the liability for Israel as a whole, and, mm-hmm. and gave, even if it not legal liability in the end, sort of gave credibility to Israel's critics that this was a genocidal operation. So you could say that Israel started to crack down on measures that could be on statements that could be interpreted as intent.
Right.
You could also,
or also you could say that some of the cabinet ministers in Israel started to, I'm not going to say self-censor, but realize that their words can be used against them in an international court of law. So you haven't heard Yoav Gallant, for instance, make references to human animals anymore.
Right.
It was highly contested what the context of those original statements were, but they appeared right there in the ICJ's ruling, quoting him, talking about flattening Gaza and human animals or Hamas human animals, all of Gazans. I mean, but the point is that he's not saying that anymore. Some other members of the cabinet are still engaged in this, very wild and cautious talk. I would ascribe that to the politics of Israel, but you're right. It has been a change.
The other area where I think it's really interesting what the ICJ said and didn't say, you know, of course, the very first provisional measure that South Africa asked for was one that the ICJ was silent on. That is, it did not grant the provisional measure, and that's ceasing all hostilities, a ceasefire.
Right.
Implicitly, the ICJ was recognizing that Israel has a right to defend itself. That some sort of military, legitimate military objective involved there, and that it wasn't going to say, no, you can't pursue that objective at all. You just have to do it in a way that's not genocidal.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that the ICJ did really take pains to address was the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The ruling's coming out at around the time when people are reporting massive famines, half of the Gazan population in famine conditions. They do, I believe, also quote in their judgment a sort of very dire depiction of humanitarian conditions in Gaza. And this is actually a second thing that Judge Barak signs off on is the commitment to enable humanitarian relief. And I think that's actually a major departure from actual Israeli policy.
Yes.
And I think it'd be really curious to see if that's one area where Israel starts to kind of comply with the ICJ's ruling more than it would it's saying it's going to say it's complying with the ruling entirely, because in other dimensions to not comply is to say, well, we're going to keep on committing genocide, which is they don't believe they're doing in the first place. But I think they see themselves vulnerable as potentially liable for causing conditions likely to bring about the destruction of a group, to paraphrase Clause 2C of the Genocide Convention, through that the siege and the limitation on humanitarian relief for Gaza.
Yes. And they have been, to a small extent, I would say, and this coincides not just with the ruling, but with pressure from the Biden administration, with just changing of opinion in Israel, a slight changing. And if you count, I'm sure you know this, but the number of trucks going through the crossings, they're above 200 now. Now, before the war, they were at 500, and some relief organizations say they should be at 1,000. But there has been an uptick since the ICJ.
They had been down in double digits.
That is
10,
correct.
20.
I would also say that I'm not sure that Benjamin Netanyahu would sign on to this, but many, I would guess that some current members of the Israeli cabinet, the war cabinet, those maybe aligned with Aaron Barak, would right now sign on to following by letter of the law everything that was written in by the court, if all parties did, because the court also said that Hamas should release all the terrorists.
Yeah.
So since Israel maybe feels vulnerability on language of some of the people within Israel, since Israel, many Israelis want more aid to flow into Gaza, they would also love to get all the hostages released. I think they would say, let us 100% follow this ruling.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's not Israel is facing, people are able to recognize that Israel is kind of painting itself back into a corner. it just in terms of international public opinion. And Israel's always been able to count on the U.S. and Europe as sort of staunch supporters no matter what. They're finding that more so than I think in any of previous conflicts, if they're reading the room correctly, they're finding that not only is the public in Europe, and especially, and in the U.S. and of course in the rest of the world, very critical of Israel at this point. It's not so much, not as much in the U.S. as in these other places, but there is, you know, on college campuses, there's this upsurge of criticism of Israel. But it's also reaching government policy, that there are people in legislatures, if not the executives in Europe and the U.S., who are very critical of Israel. And that is influencing policy. Israel, you know, the astute Israeli observers will know that it's an election year. And in the past, the election year meant that you know, Democrats and Republicans would be lobbying for the Jewish vote. In this election year, you know, the coalition it's a much more difficult electoral calculus. Michigan, not Florida, is probably a more important state electorally.
Right. And I've done some analysis where, yeah, that I would say that because of the large Muslim population there, the vote, Biden's reelection or chances of reelection, given that he won by such a narrow margin, is vulnerable. But there are many other states with actually a larger Jewish population,
yes,
or,
yeah,
you know,
sure,
choosing
sure.
Pennsylvania is a big one,
yeah.
Even Arizona, choosing to go, you know, do a 180 degrees on his own policy would probably cost him more.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have to do 180 degrees. He does have to do 10, 20, 30 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, levying sanctions on certain West Bank settlement extremists, as he did 2 weeks ago or last week. And he immediately went to Dearborn in Michigan to talk about it. So, yeah, it's not that complicated to see.
These people who are never going to come to the United States anyway cannot come to the United States. Now, I understand the politics of it, but practically that's what the decree is.
Sure. Yes. But you know, the optic, we're talking about optics here, mm-hmm. in a way that you know, we're talking about, we started talking about potential opposition within
Israel. That's a good
point,
right. If Israel can be hauled before the court based on some intemperate policies of some minor ministers or members of the Knesset, then, you know, Joe Biden, the most powerful man in the world, doing actually something with force of law is meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good point. So let me just ask you the question that before I got to know you, I would have normally started with. By letter and spirit of the law, do you think Israel is guilty of violating the laws of genocide?
By letter and spirit of the law, I don't think it is at this point. I think it is possible that it might yet do so. I think that, and let me also add that one of the reasons I say that is that
The fade out. I know you know what that means. We went for a while with David Simon. I wanted to give you the most terse portion to everyone. But if you are so inclined, want to hear more of our interview, we do offer these Pesca Plus subscription options. For a limited amount of money, you can get the show ad-free. And for a little more than that, you get these bonus conversations. It is by far the best way to avoid ads, but also to help me continue producing the show. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. These, who you're about to hear, these are protesters at the University of Pittsburgh, the local chapter of the Students for Justice in Palestine.
Biden, you can't hide!
Biden, you can't hide! You signed
up on genocide!
You signed up on genocide!
Biden, Biden, you can't hide!
Biden, Biden, you can't hide!
You signed up on genocide!
You signed up on genocide!
Sometimes the variation is, we charge you with genocide, which I checked under international law, they don't have the authority to do. Putting aside the merits of the claim, which is to say it is meritless because genocide requires intent, and there is every bit of evidence that Israel has the opposite of the intent of killing all Gazans, and certainly not the intent of killing all Palestinians. Palestinians, 2 million of them, are full citizens of Israel. But Israel may be guilty of war crimes. They may be guilty of crimes against humanity. That has yet to be adjudicated. My mind is not closed to those possibilities. When you drop 20,000-pound bombs in an urban setting, you open yourself up to war crime charges. Sometimes I hear that chant, however, and I think about it. I think about the rhyme scheme, the impetus behind it, the glee of those chanting. Maybe glee is the wrong word, but the excitement, the sometimes frenzy of such a chant. Here's another version of such a chant.
Netanyahu, can't you see?
You're allowed to kill free.
You're allowed to kill
free.
Palestine will be free.
I think if only the actual genocides, the ones that had intent, the ones that were carried out fully or partially, we're speaking of, I believe, the Rohingya, probably the Armenians, of course, the Jews during World War II, if only they had a good set of nursery rhymes to prevent them. But of course, protest is a right. The widespread outpouring of disapproval of the war in Gaza is putting pressure on U.S. politicians. So that is, in a way, politics working. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called for Netanyahu to call new elections. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called the situation in Gaza a forced famine. Biden has called the actions of the Israeli military over the top. At least these words aren't jingles. There are serious accusations and demands, and to some extent, but not a total extent, there is something to them, to some of them. I agree with a lot of Schumer's speech, though I would have preferred if he treaded more lightly on the demand that a democratic country oust its leader, even if I, as an Israeli voter, I'm not, but if I were an Israeli voter, that's actually what I would want to happen for my country. Don't know that I want Big Brother in this relationship dictating that to me. I do not think there is a forced famine in Gaza, but I am very troubled by the hunger in Gaza. The issue of famine and aid is the one where I have the most criticism of Israel. The death of Gazan civilians, that is, of course, horrible. There have been, the count is, and it's rough, and most of it comes through the Ministry of Health, which is controlled by Hamas. Israel doesn't fully rebut it. But if you look at all the sources, it's somewhere around 20,000 civilians killed and over 10,000 Hamas militants killed. You could talk all you want about things like the historic ratios of urban fighting. You could talk about the estimated 9,000 civilians that the U.S. and ISIS wound up killing in Mosul. I don't remember a mass amount of protests to this extent, to even a hundredth of this extent, when it was the actual country that the protesters are in. I very much understand that 20,000 dead, irrespective of any reasons, any goals, any excuses, is simply not acceptable to most of the world. Of course, most of the world does not care if Hamas stays as a functioning force and kills thousands more Israelis. I mean, they probably wouldn't like it, especially if there were pictures of it, but they don't really care enough to stop it. And by the way, oh, we should note the Israelis very much care. And by the way, that is exactly what Hamas wants to do. Let's not forget, I'll play this clip of the senior Hamas leader, Ghazi Hamad, speaking on Lebanese TV on October 24th.
We must remove that country because it constitutes a security, military, and political catastrophe to the Arab and Islamic nation and must be finished. We are not ashamed to say this with full force. The Al-Aqsa flood is the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth, because we have the determination, the resolve, and the capabilities to fight.
The Israelis know there is a limited appetite for slaughter. When I was there, all their biggest officials told me that. They spoke of the clock. It's a common concept in Israel. They know they have to achieve their military objectives given the constraints of the world's patience, America's patience. But they know they have to do that because it's worth it. If they don't do that, they feel, I tend to agree with them, if Hamas is left in place as a functional force, it will pretty much be the end of Israel, or at least thousands of Israelis. By the way, let us speak now of the human shield argument. The human shield reality, I would say, not so much the argument. David Brooks has a good article in the New York Times today asking, well, what would you have Israel do? I could hear all the answers right now. I'll tell you what, don't kill civilians. And I also have heard Mike, if a bank robber in the U.S. took a hostage, the police wouldn't shoot through the hostage to get the robber. That's what's going on here. I say no. I say it's a different set of circumstances. I mean, in the U.S., law enforcement knows that it has time, it has geography, it has the full presence of their forces and force of law and international acceptance or indifference on their side. The better analogy is Nazis during World War II embedding themselves in schools and civil homes. What would the U.S. do? We know what the U.S. would do. They'd go in and uproot the Nazis. In the Civil War, Confederate forces embedded themselves in Fredericksburg. What did the Union do? The Union shelled. The Union took the city of Fredericksburg. They burned it down. Civilians huddled in cellars. Some were killed. There is a popular argument, and this was in The Atlantic, and I quoted it on the show, about not going in, that Israel should not have gone in. And this argument is not offered by strident anti-Zionists who don't think Israel should exist in the first place. It's offered by those who at least say they're thinking of Israel's best interest. Don't fall into the trap. Don't invade Gaza. That's exactly what Hamas wants. Okay. A, acknowledging that Hamas wants to earn the world's sympathy through the death of Palestinian civilians. That I agree with. That's what they want. You are accurate in that assessment. B, just because Hamas wants something doesn't mean it's actually in Hamas's interest. C, not engaging Hamas is very much what Hamas would most want, to get away with the mass slaughter of October 7th unscathed. That would be Hamas's dream. Then they could execute the second time, the third time, the fourth time pretty easily. The reason Hamas has built hundreds, 300-400 miles of tunnels is because Hamas wants to operate within their hundreds of miles of tunnels. And they use innocent civilians above their hundreds of miles of tunnels as insurance that they could carry out their operations, which would lead to inflicting pain on Israelis through poor, innocent civilian Gazans. What they want to do is put themselves under the Gazans in order to keep operating in the tunnels. An Israeli policy of, well, you guys go ahead and keep operating in the tunnels, well, that would just embolden, guarantee their next attack. Hamas would scarcely dream of a better outcome. So if you're going to say don't give Hamas what it wants, we disagree on if it is right to want Israel to come in and to wage the war that it has been raging. But it is 100% the case that Hamas very much wants to be left alone and operate unfettered. I also understand every single part of what I said will be criticized by critics of Israel. Many people listening now, if they're still with me, have been yelling at their earbuds. These people are not buying, I would say, any of my premises. They will say things like, you know, Israel isn't truly under threat. It's a world power, just better monitor the fence that they built and they wouldn't face harm or even extinction, right? So they say Israel's not truly under threat, or they say Israelis deserve to be under threat, or they say Israel's an illegitimate state from the inception, so it has no right to self-defense, or they say, you know, Israel could never truly defeat Hamas. It's a fool's game. They say something like, you know, Israel's goal isn't threat neutralization, it's bloodthirsty revenge. The Israelis are lying about the Hamas tactic of human shields. That's another one. They don't engage fully in the human shields argument as an actual tactic. Sometimes they say, okay, fine, they're using human shields, but so what? You still can't harm the civilians. We have to let them get away with using human shields. I know all these arguments. I've grappled with them. I'm not going to argue against each one. I just know this. I've come to a different assessment on each point. But I would ask the Israelis that given that they know that there's a clock, right? And given that images of carnage are not just somewhat important, but they're really the overriding consideration in our modern world, the U.S., the whole world was torn asunder, not because of police brutality as a concept, but because of images of George Floyd suffering. It wasn't the stats, it wasn't the narrative, it wasn't the social reality, it was the images. Given that Israel has shown a somewhat sophisticated understanding of the realities of modern war, I ask, is Israel really 100% committed to getting aid to Gaza? I think some Israeli leaders are, or some Israeli non-leaders hope their leaders are, many Israeli citizens. I don't know exactly what the Israeli War Council, the three members who make almost all the decisions on Israel, would say. I put very little past Netanyahu in terms of being cynical. But the main argument is something like, well, while we'd like to get the aid in, the realities of inspecting trucks, it just forces a situation where not enough aid can get in. But I do think that there are some, probably within the highest ranks of Israeli power, and I know this because they said so, who wouldn't mind a siege. They think a siege might be good for Israeli interests. And they might not say this aloud, but they know the history of warfare. And they know the tactic of putting a lot of pressure on the populace sometimes leads to the populace turning against their oppressors, i.e., in the Israeli conception, Hamas. That's often how wars are won, or were won. But it's not how wars should be won by the, quote, most moral army in the world. What they call themselves. I could be wrong. I'm not an aid expert. I'm not a truck inspections logistic expert. I know this is not easy for me to say get the aid in. It's a lot harder than that. I definitely know if they throw open the gates of Kerem Shalom, that is the border crossing on the Israeli side. Egypt has one too. But if they just throw open the gates, Hamas is going to take advantage to arm, to feed, and to power themselves, not the citizens. But I have slightly different opinions on the two main extremely difficult choices that Israel has. One, the choice to fight Hamas, even knowing that Hamas purposefully puts civilians in the way, which in general is Israel has to do it with as much care as they can, but it's a horrible situation, but there's nothing that can be done. And then you have the hard choice of how much aid should get in. And Israel would say, we're doing as best we can. And I am saying, I do not know that that's the case. I am far from knowing that that's the case. I am a bit surprised that Israel has allowed the famine to progress. It's not quite a famine, but the hunger to progress as far as it has. And it makes me wonder if there are elements, powerful elements within Israel who don't mind the situation. I do think you have to pursue Hamas and not commit war crimes while doing so. I also think Israel should try with all the might of all the slogans that they and we espouse, things like Middle East's only democracy and America's great ally and that moral army thing. They should keep the Gazans from famine. They really should. And even if they do have the excuse, if you want me to call it the explanation, that yes, terrorists will take advantage if you don't do that with care, even though that is a valid excuse, they still have to do it. These terrorists are willing to sacrifice their own people. Yes, agreed. But when it comes to Israelis' enemies, it's easy to find fault. But when it comes to Israel's humanitarian imperatives, hard as it is, they have to find solutions. And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara and Joel Patterson, and Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. To advertise on The Gist, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Doom Peru, G Peru, Do Peru, and thanks for listening.